So we are now audio recording, and I will mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. And Alan, you'll have to unmute yourself. Looks good. Okay, so welcome all, and if there are any new people with us tonight in particular, welcome. We welcome guests anytime to the Ottawa PC User Group. If you want to join, that's great, but don't feel an obligation to do so. So the process, we'll go through the deck of the stuff that was sent in advance, and then we will open it up for general other questions and so forth. If we don't get a chance to get a question answered that you wanted covered, by all means, send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and it'll be up front on next week's deck. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chris, and welcome, everybody. We have a pretty full agenda, I think, tonight, so we'll kick right off. First thing, a heads up on the newsletter that's coming out probably on the weekend or shortly thereafter. Lawrence Patterson, our program director, has had a panic on at work for quite a while, and he's not going to be able to generate speakers for the program. So you'll find in the newsletter an article asking you for suggestions for topics, for presentations, to find speakers who would give presentations to the group, and asking you if you would consider making a presentation either for a monthly meeting, one of our weekly Q&As, or for one of our members' favorites nights. So I encourage you to read the article and respond appropriately. And speaking of members' favorites, we have scheduled the next members' favorites for our September meeting, which will be September the 8th. And because we're hoping to get more members making presentations, we have a drop-dead offer. Any member who gives a presentation, that is, who's not a member of the board of directors, we've excluded ourselves from this. We're going to have a live poll to choose the best presentation. And the member who gives the best presentation in September is going to be the proud owner of a 2 terabyte external USB drive, as pictured. So again, this is an extract from the newsletter, and the details are there, and we'll be following up later on in the year, a bit closer to the time. But for now, start thinking of that presentation and start putting all your good stuff together. Okay, first thing we have on the agenda tonight, in real stuff, is a follow-up by Chris.
Yeah, so Tom last week, and Tom's online tonight, so feel free to chime in if you want, Tom. He had a question about backing up through FTP file transfer protocol or secure file transfer protocol. And he was looking for certain capabilities. And I thought a lot of the regular backup programs could accomplish this in a way. And I use EaseUS to do backup, but there are others out there that offer these same sort of capabilities. And they do have this idea of backing up your backup file, so your image backup file, via FTP as a secondary backup. So it is really a secondary backup. You have to do a normal local backup, and then it will copy the image backup file to the FTP. So I went through Tom's list of things, his preferences or his to-do list on it, and he had compressed. And so they certainly all of the backup programs do compress the backup file. It is a single file you will end up with. Encrypted, yes, you can encrypt in all of these programs. Most of them will do incrementals in the free version. The one I know of that won't is Macrium Reflect. In the free version, they don't do incrementals, but in the paid version, they can do incrementals. Command line options, that's another one that usually comes in the paid versions, so they have the capability of doing that. The easily find and restore file folder, disk easily and replicating the hierarchy. Not, you can do it, but it's not quite so easy, because what you really have to do is you have to go to your FTP server, download the entire image backup file to your local computer, and then you could access any of the files and folders that are within that backup file. Shadow copies to handle open files, all of the backup programs do that. Continue uninterrupted backups. The backups themselves typically know if there is an interruption in the backup will actually just fail and give you an error message. However, if the backup completes successfully, the FTP of a backup to your backup file, so your offsite copy, so to speak. Typically, those ones do allow for interruptions in the stream. So they'll have retries that are available in that FTP transfer of the backup file. Background backups low priority. Yes, they all allow you to prioritize your CPU, so it doesn't take up a lot on there. Bandwidth, probably not so much. It'll basically use all your available bandwidth that it can. Timestamps, yes, and version controls, yes. So it's not exactly, I think, what Tom was looking for, but it may sort of suffice in a situation where you just want to have an offsite copy of your regular backup file.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And don't go away, because I think this next one's yours too.
Yeah, this is, and let me just paste this into the chat. So this, Kevin Stratford, he's an interesting character. He actually worked for Microsoft, and he left Microsoft to become a full-time YouTuber. And he has tons and tons of videos out there on various things, a lot about Microsoft software and how to use it and tips and tricks and things like that. He's a real rapid-fire guy, so he crams an awful lot into all of his videos. So typically you have to pause it and maybe rewind it a little bit to catch everything that he covers. But three that he had, which I thought were interesting as follow-ups in a way to our talks about how to use Zoom, he has the top 20 of his Zoom tips and tricks, top 20 video hacks, and top new features in Zoom. And that was, I think that came out in December or January. So it is relatively new in terms of the features. And I learned a couple of new things about Zoom that I didn't know beforehand. So I highly encourage people that are looking to get the most out of Zoom, take a look at his videos.
Okay. Okay, talking about presentations, Linda suggested a different way of doing things, and the idea was to basically just put up a topic or several topics, hold a meeting, and see what people provide at the time. Kind of a real-time meeting, I guess. No predefined stuff. We're going to try something a bit like that. Basically looking at scam messages. I don't know about everybody else, but I certainly see my fair share of scam messages. A while ago, I was getting a message one or two every day from somebody who told me that my payment had been made, and I just had to check the attached invoice, which was an XLS file, and obviously had a malware macro component to it. So we're interested in knowing what kind of scams are out there right now. We have our Fraud Watch page, which lists some of the scams that we've seen and some of the red flags that these things raise and how to avoid them. But I guess our question is, what's going around currently? So if you receive, and if you're like me, you receive these things and you immediately delete them, so you don't have anything in the pipe, as it were. But if you do get scam messages or telephone calls in the next week or two, send us a copy of the message or a description of the scam that's going on the telephone call. Send it along to us or have it ready at the question and answer session on April the 7th. Now, it's a couple of weeks, so it gives you some time to receive some scams. and then we'll review all the submissions. I got a couple of examples. I get scams from this guy all the time. But it's pretty obvious, you know, it says the credentials for the bink. Well, he's looking for the bank credentials, clearly. And then he tells me on a text message that he's been arrested in Miami and I should send him bitcoins. Well, you know, there's a whole pile of spelling errors and Chris 248, I don't know, and bitcoins. They're all kind of big red flags that just these are scams and throw them away. Anyway, we're also going to have a little fun tonight, so I'll let Chris talk about this.
Yeah, so we are having, we're currently aiming to have members favorite in September, and Alan mentioned about this, that so the members favorite, for anybody who's not familiar with it, there are many presentations that anybody can give, usually about 10 to 15 minutes each, on anything you find interesting. So it could be a program, piece of hardware, a service, anything at all that you'd like to give a little mini presentation on. You could just talk or you can give a little PowerPoint deck, really up to you how you want to present it. And so they're usually fun presentations. We usually get four, maybe five different presentations on that evening and a wide variety of topics. And as Alan mentioned, we will have the 2 terabyte portable drive that will be for the voted on by the people watching the presentations as to which they think is the best, not including any presentations that are put on by board members. And just as an example of how it will come across, so you should be seeing a poll on your screen now. So go ahead and answer the poll, and we'll leave this up for just about a minute or so. So we have 1 of 33 has voted, 2. And I think I think you see the results as live. I'm not 100% sure.
No?
Okay. So I'm seeing the live results coming in. And so I can see that we're up to 20 people have voted, 21. I'll give it another. It's been running for 40 seconds now. I'll let it run to 1 minute, and then I will end the polling. So another 15 seconds. And I will stop the polling now, and I will share the results. So I presume everybody can see the results on their screen now?
Yes, lots of emails and lots of telephone calls.
Yeah.
Some text messaging.
So I guess they highlight the top winner, shall we say, in orange. And then the other ones are shown. So this is what we will use at the September members' favorite to decide who wins the portable drive. So everybody who's on the meeting at September will have an opportunity to vote. And with that, I will stop sharing the results, and I will let Alan continue on.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So that's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a share, but this time it's a hardware system. I look at this guy, Gary Sims is from Android Authority, but he does these YouTube videos on a whole raft of computer technology. And this particular one I came across just the other day for a hardware power supply. And it's a review that he's done on this system that he actually bought for his own use, and he says he's been using it extensively. So I thought it might be interesting for people who are suffering trying to charge multiple devices. And it's fairly cheap, 35 US nominal. Now, maybe there are shipping and customs duties on top of that, I don't know. But for that, you get a USB-C quick charge port, a USB-A quick charge port, 3 regular USB-A charging ports, and there's even a wireless charging port on top of the box. And the really neat thing is it has this little LCD display, and it shows you the voltage and current draw on individual channels, so you can see how individual devices, how close they are to to being fully charged when the amperage drops off, I guess. Anyway, there's the couple of URLs there, which Chris has pasted into the chat window. So if you're at all interested in hardware power supplies, then that's certainly an interesting option. I encourage you at least to look at the video.
Yeah, Alan, if I can interrupt, I think the neatest thing about that is that first one on the list, that power delivery port at 65 watts. So if you have a laptop that can charge over USB Type-C, rather than using the brick and cable and everything that's provided by your laptop manufacturer, you could actually plug it into this device and get, you know, up to 65 watts of power delivered over that. Now, you would need a cable. You have to make sure your USB-C cable that you get is capable of power delivery, but they definitely are available out there, and it could mean that you either have a spare charger for your laptop, or you can just forget about your existing laptop charging.
Actually, that's exactly what Gary Sims said. He bought this thing so he can charge up his MacBook Pro, I think it is.
Yeah.
So he uses that port to do that. And the regular charger, he just leaves in his carry case, so it's ready to go when he walks out of the door.
Yeah.
And the other point he mentioned was, if he had to buy a new charger for his MacBook, this thing is way cheaper and much more flexible. So it's an interesting piece of kit. Okay, moving along. Another follow-up, and this is for Chris.
At the March meeting, I showed how to use AutoType in KeePass in order to log on to a website semi-automatically. But it can actually be a lot easier than what I showed. And this came about because Jocelyn asked a question about AutoType, and Alan actually found a video that showed some of what I'm going to talk about tonight, and then I dug into it a little bit further. So the next slide.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so what I showed in the top left one, where you go into KeePass and you double-click the URL, that opens your browser at the login page if you set it up correctly, and then you click in the field for the sign-in, then you switch back to KeePass, you double-click on the username, then you switch back to the VirusTotal, in this case the sign-in page, the web page, you paste it in there, you switch back to the KeePass, and you double-click the password, and then you switch back, or you can switch back once and do the perform auto type login. And so then it will go and it'll go back to your browser. It will put in your username, tab to the next field, put in your password, and hit enter. But that's, even that is, to me, too much back and forth. I found a better way. So a simpler approach. Now, the first thing is you do still have to set up your entry in KeePass for all of the information. You have to have the name of the site, you have to put in your username, and you have to put in your password, and you have to put in the URL for the sign-in page for the site. But that's only once you have to do that, so that's normal. But then it can be as simple as if you manually go to, for example, the VirusTotal or whatever login page is, and you just click in the field for the username and you press Control-Alt-A, which is customizable. You can set it to something else if you want. It will automatically have KeePass look up the entry with the same name as the site you're on. In this case, the site name is in the title bar, VirusTotal. If it finds one that's the same name or a very close match, it could be VirusTotal space login or something like that, then it will automatically take the information of the username and the password and feed that into the website. It will work if title bar is the same as an entry in KeePass and the default of username, tab, password, enter works to log on. And KeePass has to actually be running and not locked. Now, if it's running and it's locked, then you will get prompted automatically to log into KeePass so that it can access the information for you. So it's not bad. The worst case scenario is if KeePass isn't running at all, and in that case, Control-Alt-A, just nothing happens.
Does the title have to be identical, or can it be a subset?
No, it's very close, but I'll talk about that in a couple of slides. Okay, so another way you can do it, and because KeePass has to be running in order for this to function anyways, if you just go to KeePass and you double-click the URL entry, that will open up the browser at the login page. So the benefit of going that way, of starting off in KeePass rather than in your browser, is that first off, double-click will get you to the correct login page, so you don't have to dig down to get to the login for any particular site. And you know the KeePass is open and unlocked, so it will continue to function. So then all you have to do is click on the username field, press Control-Alt, bang, you're logged in. So it works really, really quite well. Now, there are some things that can cause it to fail, and they're all, you can work around all of them if you do get failures. So the first one is if different keystrokes are needed. So the default in KeePass is, type in a username, hit the tab key, type in your password, and hit enter. If that works, that's great. But if it doesn't, then you can override the default and you can do anything you want. So you could do username, enter, and then password, tab, enter, whatever. Whatever's required for you to log into a particular website. And I covered this at the March meeting, so I won't go into detail on how to do that. The next thing that can happen is delays at websites. So Adobe is a case in point on this one. So when I signed in Adobe, first off, you don't do, you know, your username, or in this case, like an email address, and then tab. So what you do is you have a little bit of a different thing in here. I have username and enter. But there's usually a delay there, and I guess it's they're looking up to see if this is a valid account or not. And so it might take half a second or a second before it actually continues on. Well, KeePass doesn't know that, you know, the next screen hasn't come up prompting for the password yet, and so it passes on the information before Adobe actually asks for it. So the secret to that is you can add in into the customization for the autotype sequence, you can put in delay and then a number of milliseconds. So you can cause that to pause for just a little bit for give a chance for the next screen to come up, which in Adobe's case would be the password field. So you can see that in that. Actually, go back for just a second, Alan. So you can see here I ended up putting in username, enter. Then I did a delay of half a second. Then I put in the password and enter. And for me, that works well on Adobe's site. Another problem that you can run into is login fields that are already filled in. A lot of websites will say, do you want me to remember your username? And so the next time you try to sign in on that site, it'll already have your username in there. Well, that'll screw up KeePass because KeePass doesn't know that there's something already there. So in this case here, I've got chris.taylor@opcug.ca is already there. If I ran KeePass normally, it would duplicate my name, and of course that would fail because my email address is not chris.taylor@opcug.ca, chris.taylor@opcug.ca. So what you can do in that case is add in clear field into the sequence. And this is one of the things that I think is maybe useful is it doesn't hurt to add clear field in all the time. Right? If there's nothing there, there's nothing to remove. But if it ever happens that there's something in the particular field, the clear field command will actually empty it out, and then you can put it in. So you can see that my default sequence here has been modified to clear field, and then put in username, tab, password, enter. And that works for any site that I've already got a username popping in. The next one is where you get a mismatch on the title bar and the KeePass entry. So an example on this is Indigo, Chapters Indigo, and the title bar for their login screen is Canada's Biggest Bookstore. Well, I don't want a KeePass entry named that because I want to be able to find it easily, and I'm not going to remember that Chapters Indigo is the entry in KeePass is actually called Canada's Biggest Bookstore. So what you can do for that is make sure in your browser that the login page is open, and then you go into edit the KeePass entry, and under the section where in autotype it says use custom sequences for the specific windows, and you can click on add, and then you see in the other window there, it brings up, if you click on the target window chevron pointing down, it'll bring up all of the windows that are open on your computer, browser or otherwise. So I just look down the list and I can see that, oh, there's the one that I want. It's Canada's biggest bookstore for buy books, toys, all the rest of it. Click on that, and then it will actually look for that target window where it wants to be able to feed the information through to. So that'll get around any mismatch on title bars and key pass entries if you do that. The last one that you can run into a problem with, and you will have to have gone through the previous slide on these as well, an example is a duplicate login page name. So Henry's and Expedia, their login page is both just called sign in. Okay. So I could go and put Henry's and go through that previous slide where I actually pick out the tab that I want, you know, whatever the window is going to actually be named. And I can do the same for Expedia, but then they're both identical. So how does KeePass know what to do? Well, if it sees a duplicate like that, when you do that Control-Alt-A, a box will pop up and it'll say, well, which one do you want? You've got two that are listed as sign-in, and it identifies them, Henry's and Expedia. And if I'm trying to log in at Henry's, I just click on that. Or if I want to go to the Expedia site, then I just click on that, and it'll continue on with the sequence. So those are the four things that I found can cause a little bit of headaches where you have to customize things. But once you go through all your entries in KeePass and you automate all of these things, I found that it works very reliably. And for me, it's as simple as going into KeePass, double-click the URL, click in the login username field, Control-Alt-A, and you get logged in. So it's very, very fast and easy to use KeePass to automate the login on pretty much any website. And the last slide,
Does this work on Android as well as Windows?
No, I don't believe so. This is I have not seen a port for Android that includes all of these specifics, but there are some that claim to do auto logins, but I don't know how customizable they are. But there are some that claim to be able to do auto logons. So I think you might have to play with them to see whether they will allow you to overcome all of the difficulties like that. So the auto type customizations, there are a lot of different things that are, I've just gone through a couple of the keywords. There are a lot of other ones that are available. I think that they should be able to handle just about any circumstance that you'll run into. And the URL that is there will allow you to see all of the different customizations and how to get around these problem areas. So I found it to be quite useful. I will have another follow-up to the using KeePass in that I found a better port than KeePass Droid. And so at some future Q&A, I'll be talking about a much, much better port. So I'll probably try and look into the auto login on that port as well and see how it works.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I must try that auto type thing. I've been using the double click and paste into the menu thing, but clearly it would be easier to use the auto type thing.
Yeah.
By the way, Alan, well, your picture is missing.
I don't know what we're talking about. Sorry, I can't. There we go. There I am.
I see you.
Okay. All right. If anybody attended the, I'm sure most people did, attended the monthly meeting last week, we had a great presentation by Chris on password management. And we had about 70 people, more than 70 people, I think. And unfortunately, I gave everybody a break and didn't promote the club membership. So if anybody isn't a club member, or anybody who is a club member and you have friends and relatives who would like to join, you have a couple of weeks still. If you pay your membership right now, you will become a paid-up member. And all paid-up members, now that's everybody who's a current member right this minute, as of March 31st, you'll get an extension of 1 year on your current membership. So new members essentially buy 2 years worth of membership for the price of $20. So a reminder. Okay, our first question tonight came in I think this is actually Tom. How do you encrypt a hard drive or a solid state drive using a hardware password in BIOS or UEFI? And does adding it delete all of the current data? And Chris and I didn't really know the answers, so I posted this one on the member forum, and we didn't get exactly the right answer, the same the answer required, but Andrew posted some information about BitLocker, which is Windows hard disk, full disk encryption system. And it's only available to those of you who are using Windows 10 Pro. So if you're like me and you only have Windows 10 Home, then you can't use BitLocker. Some of us think that's a good thing. However, one of the things he points out, which I didn't know about, was that BitLocker will, by default, or to get the best storage, best protection, will store the encryption keys on the computer's TPM chip, which is a trusted platform module. So this is a chip which is built into the motherboard and available for things like this. And sure, if you look up the documentation from Microsoft on BitLocker, they say that you get the most protection if you use it with the trusted platform module. Andrew went on to say that if you use BitLocker and you encrypt the whole hard drive, then if anybody steals the drive, because all the data is encrypted, then they can't access it. But the downside, if you forget the password, there's no way to get back in. So don't forget your encryption password. Encrypt doesn't destroy the data. It basically just encrypts it, makes it unreadable. But he notes that before you encrypt the whole drive, you'd probably make a backup of the data and keep that offline. Anyway, and then I did a little bit of research on the web, and I found this thing called self-encrypting drives. And these are hard drives which have full disk encryption essentially built in. And there's a couple of standards, which if you know anything about these things, you know more than I do. But basically, the drive will automatically encrypt and decrypt your data, so they consider it to be transparent encryption. And here's the kicker. Increasingly adopted by government and the military. So you know what that means. It means that these drives are pretty expensive. However, one of the articles that I read said, well, think about conventional SSDs, especially made by Samsung, because you can buy these things for, some of them are less than $100. And if you read the specs, not only will you find that they read and write really quickly, but these particular drives support 256-bit encryption. And they're compliant with one of the standards, but I don't think they're compliant with the higher kind of military grade type standard. But, you know, for that kind of price, and if you want hard full disk encryption, then it might be worthwhile looking into. So this is all I know about SEDs. They have an onboard processor, essentially a chip built into the drive, and its only job is to encrypt and decrypt the data on the fly. They generate a unique randomized symmetric data encryption key, a DEK, and they store that encryption key on the drive itself. And so that means that the encryption key never gets onto your system memory where somebody could attack it. And because it's stored in the drive, you don't know it as the owner of the drive. The value isn't made available to you. But it's all transparent, so you don't need to do anything about it. But what you do need is you need a unique, secure, strong password on the drive, so that it locks and unlocks as you power it on and off. So there you go. If you're interested in self-encrypting drives or hard disk encryption, full disk encryption, there's a couple of things that you can certainly look at. And then there's the mere mortals like me. If you've only got a few files or the odd folder or two that contain sensitive information, then maybe full disk encryption is a bit too much of a good thing. So why don't you consider encrypting just the file or a number of files or a whole folder full of files? Or, by the same token, use a fully encrypted so-called container. So I've written articles on a couple of these things, and the first one was from 2009, a Windows program called Xcrypt. And so there's the thing, you can look at that. I still use this thing. There's actually two versions of it now, so if you look on the web for Xcrypt, you may come across the first URL here, which is the free version, the absolute free version, the open source version, which I still use, and they're referring to this as the legacy version. And clearly this system was quite popular, so much so that the guy basically took it commercial. And so now you've got Xcrypt 2, which, as you see, has a range of prices available. There is a free version. I haven't tried it, so I don't know how good it is as compared to the original Xcrypt. I'll show you how Xcrypt works in a second, and basically that's all I need. But it gets pretty pricey if you're it's obviously software as a service. He wants, for the premium version, he wants $4.67 Canadian per month, and for business it's $13 and change per month per user. So if you've got a bunch of people using it in a business, that could be a pretty pricey system. I don't know how good it is, whether it's worth that kind of money, I've got no idea. Anyway, here's my top secret file. And I've got some really important files. I've got my code cleaner macro, which I'm going to sell and make my fortune one of these days. I've got my passport photograph or image of my passport there. And as treasurer of the PC user group, I've taken all the money and I've stuck it into a bunch of offshore funds. So I have to keep a list of those in a secret folder so you and the board, nobody can find the money. So what I need to do is I need to open my folder and I need to right click on one of the files. And that will bring up a context menu, which is built into Windows. So here's Xcrypt popping up. When I check Xcrypt, then I get the option to encrypt my file. And once I've done that, it asks me for a password. So taking Chris's session last week to heart, I have a really strong password. It's A-L-A-N, all four characters, and I typed it twice just so it makes sure it's absolutely correct. And Xcrypt's fine. It doesn't care. I've only got a short password. But you see what it's done? It's now encrypted my XLS file, and it's changed the name, so it's a dash XLS. And it's got a .axx extension. So that tells the program that it's an encrypted file. And sure enough, it is encrypted, because if I send this, if Chris comes along and steals my encrypted file and loads it into Excel so he can check where the offshore funds are, and you can see there that it thinks it's some kind of text file, comma separated file or whatever, and it's trying to tell you to read it in as delimited, but you can see that basically it's all garbage characters. So it's a completely encrypted, completely unreadable file with a top secret password. So very, very safe. If I want to decrypt it in order to load it into Excel myself, for example, I right click on the AXX file, the encrypted version. It pops up Xcrypt. I choose decrypt. I enter my secret password, and bingo, I've got my offshorefunds.xls back and ready to use. So that's how to do an individual file, but clearly I could encrypt the whole folder. So if I right-click on the top secret folder, and I choose ActScript and I choose to encrypt that folder, it will ask me for the password again, and I'll give it the password. And now you can see clearly that I've got an encrypted folder. Well, you can't really. It doesn't show you any difference from anything else. But if I now open that encrypted folder, what you find is that all of the files inside the folder have been encrypted. So by encrypting the folder, you encrypt all of the files inside it. So you can do an individual file, or you can do multiple files in a folder. So that's really a very simple way to do it, and very easy to deal with. Now, I also run Linux, as you know, quite frequently. I spend more time in Linux than I do in Windows. So I need an encryption system which is multi-platform. And ActScript is a Windows program, and it doesn't really run in Linux. So I looked for a different version. I used to use a program called TrueCrypt, and then it got some bad press in terms of review of its security. But what happened was some people forked the open source product and created this product called VeraCrypt. And so VeraCrypt is a cross-platform solution. There's a Windows version and a Linux version. I think there's also a version for the Mac if you use those things. And it works a bit differently. It basically creates a container. So when you run VeraCrypt, it gives you a choice of all these drives, but you really have nothing to pick from. It's completely blank. So the first thing you have to do is check this Create the Volume button. And now it takes you into a wizard, and you can create all kinds of different volumes. You can create an encrypted file container, which is what I want to use. That's the default. But you can also do partitions or entire drives if you so wish. You have two choices in terms of the type of volume, the standard volume, or the other one's called a hidden volume, and this is some magic where in theory, the container is hidden, so nobody can force you to acknowledge the password. Well, I'm sure this is just a hidden file. I'm sure it's not really terribly difficult to find if you really try. However, I'm only interested in a simple volume. So the next thing it wants to know is, where do I want to put my volume? So I said I want it on my data drive, and I want it to be in a file called Strongbox. And I clicked, by default, it checked Never Save History. So I'm going to get this Strongbox. And now I have to choose which algorithm I want. So by default, it uses AES, which is a military government-grade system. And I'm using 512-bit encryption, which is pretty strong. But if you don't like that, there are lots of other choices. And if you don't want AES, I'm sure you know what all these other choices must be. And so you've got lots of different things you can choose. But personally, I just go with the default. And then the next thing you need to do is decide how big it's going to be. And I don't want a huge drive, so I've chosen 40 megabytes as my container. And finally, it needs a password. So again, I go back into the depths of my strong password box and use that magic password that I used before. But you see, I can also have some other choices. I've got a choice here to use key files. So I could have a key file on a USB stick, and VeraCrypt would require both the password, the software password, and the USB drive to be present with that key file on it. So it's like a second line of defense, if you like. So I give it my strong password, and it says tilt. You must be joking. That's really easy to crack. You should use at least 20 characters. Are you sure you want to use a short password? Oh, yes, I'm perfectly sure. I like short passwords. And now the next thing it wants to do, it's got to generate the encryption key. And what it wants you to do now is wave the mouse around. So you, as you wave the mouse around, and this red bar down here changes to yellow and eventually changes to green, and you've made your encryption key very, very random, apparently. And so eventually when you get to the green, if you want to go that far, you can choose to format the container, and off you go. And it says, yes, the VeriCrypt volume has been successfully created. And so here we are. Here it is. You can see it clearly. It's somewhere in there. And it's not one of those file folders. It's actually a file, remember. It's an encrypted container. It's basically a file. And you see it's actually down the bottom of the list here in the list of files. It's a file called Strongbox. And you can see it's 40 megabytes in size. So now when I open VeriCrypt, I have to choose a drive letter, because what it's going to do, it's going to take this container and it's going to create a virtual drive. So I've chosen to create drive X. And once I've chosen drive X, I have to go down and select my file, so I can browse for the file and choose Strongbox, and then I can tell it to mount the Strongbox. And of course, as soon as I want to mount the Strongbox, it wants to know my secure password, which you remember is Alan. Remember that? And so you put Alan and you hit OK, and then it takes a few seconds. I'm sure this is, it must be really strongly encrypted, because it used to be snappy. When it was TrueCrypt, it would be like instant. Now with VeriCrypt, it takes a few seconds while it thinks about it and decrypts it and lets it in. But eventually it will tell me, yes, here's drive X using your Strongbox file, and it's just about 40 megabytes in size. And when you go to Microsoft Windows, you find that not only do you have drive C and drive D and some USB keys and SD cards and things, but you also have this this local drive X, which is a virtual drive, which is the decrypted Strongbox container. So if we look at drive X, you can see I've copied over the top secret files here from drive X. And when I go in and I dismount that container, then I can exit the program, and then once again I can try and load Strongbox. Remember, it's just a file, so I try to pull it in, and it opens up in Notepad, and you can see that it's basically just garbage characters. So that's the strongly encrypted version of all my files, and I dare you to try and find out where your money is in the offshore XLS file. Now, one trick. You also know that I use Free File Sync to do file and folder synchronization. So I synchronize my data drive with my USB flash drive. But now I've got a problem, because Strongbox is on the data drive, but when I open and close it in VeriCrypt, it doesn't change the date timestamp. So Free File Sync looks at it, and because it's just looking at date timestamps, it says, oh, well, nothing changed, so I don't need to back it up. Even if I've edited all the files in the container, it doesn't change the date timestamp on the container itself. So the workaround for that is to change the date timestamp on the container. And to do that, I use a program called touch.exe. I just run a command, touch Strongbox. It changes the date timestamp to the current time, and then Free File Sync sees it as a new file, a modified file, and copies it over to my backup. And if you're not familiar with touch, it's actually a Unix command which has been ported to Windows, and it's part of a package called UNX Utils, and it's available from Wikipedia. So there we have a number of ways of encryption, and for all you PCUG members out there, I just want to point out that my offshorefunds.xls isn't really a list of offshore accounts. Your money is perfectly safe in TD Canada Trust and what's the other one? Scotiabank, their online system. Used to be called Tangerine. Oh, it's Tangerine.
Tangerine, yeah.
There's your money. And my XLS file is actually a program that does momentum calculations for vehicle-to-vehicle crashes. So there you go. So we have about 10 minutes. Does anybody have any other questions, comments, or things you would like to share?
As before you go there, Alan, may I ask you to go to the second slide of this encryption series, please? Because I believe you have an inaccurate statement.
The ACScript one?
No, in regards to the BitLocker or similar type. Okay. Okay. It's about the backup. Line next one. Okay. So I don't believe that what you're stating in parentheses is true unless it's an image backup. Because if it's
I think what he's saying is, this is Andrew's comment. I think what he's saying is that if you use BitLocker, then you encrypt all the data on the hard drive. If you were to lose the password, you would be completely lost. So what you probably want to do is make a backup of all your data before you encrypt it. And it probably doesn't matter how you make that backup. It could be a backup in the clear, or it could be an image backup. But just so you have a backup that you can deal with that's not encrypted.
I understand that. And that in itself is fine. But the statement, you would clearly make a backup of your data before encrypting it. I guess I take this as being to say that if you don't do that and you've lose the encryption key or the password, whatever it's called, and you have backups after that, you've lost the ability to access those information on the backup itself. Because the backup is like any other program that's accessing the encrypted drive and the files contained within. Once the files are accessed by that other program, they're unencrypted. And if they're stored onto another device, they would be stored unencrypted, is my argument.
Yeah, you're right on that. I think this is just the statement here came about on the idea that if you're worried about the idea that encrypting your drive, all of a sudden you're going to lose all access to everything. You know, people make backups all the time, don't they? And so you could always recover from that. But your point about the idea that the backups that you make after the drive is encrypted, the backups will be unencrypted backups is correct.
Yeah. That's anyway, so I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, good point.
Another thing actually on BitLocker, which I'm not 100% sure, but I think that on home, it still has the ability to do full disk encryption. And if you have a relatively modern computer, surely if it has a TPM chip, Windows will automatically, on a clean install, it will encrypt the volume using full disk encryption. But I'm not 100% sure about all the details on that, which is why I didn't input to the process beforehand. But if anybody's interested, you could look into it a little bit more. I think home, you do have BitLocker, but only for full disk encryption.
I don't think you do on home, although I have a little netbook that I believe comes with BitLocker encryption and Windows 10 home, so There may be exceptions or wrinkles.
To Tom's point, I've read it seems to be a fairly constant. You almost seem to see it every 2 months where someone has said, oh, my God, I there's something wrong with my Windows 10 home system. And don't you know it's encrypted and I have no idea what the BitLocker key is.
Yeah, okay. I'm just looking at a Microsoft support article, and it says, it actually uses BitLocker technology, but they say encryption. BitLocker isn't available on Windows 10 Home Edition. However, they do have device encryption. So you can sign into Windows with an administrator account and then select Start, Settings, Update and Security, Device Encryption. And if device encryption doesn't appear, it isn't available, you may be able to use standard BitLocker encryption instead. If device encryption is turned off, turn it on. So it uses BitLocker's technologies, but it's not called BitLocker at that level on Windows Home. It's actually just called device encryption. And so basically it would just... Yeah, I'm guessing it will just go ahead and it'll encrypt everything. And my understanding is some newer computers will come with it enabled automatically. And it's totally transparent to the end user. But if you ever lose your login ID into Windows, you will lose the ability to get access to any of your information. If the drive is not encrypted, you could just pull the drive, plug it into another computer, and access the files that are on that drive. But if you have device encryption on, you can't do that. So you have to make sure that you have a rescue account, as I've recommended in here, as well as articles in the newsletter. You have to make sure that you don't lose all your Windows account access, or else you will lose access to all the data. I'll paste into the chat this article that I'm looking at right now, just so that if people are interested, you can go. And this is right out of the mouth of Microsoft.
It must be true. So any other questions?
I don't see anything new in the chat. A comment from Stuart Bruce, the older I get, the more wrinkles I find. Yeah, there's a lot of wrinkles to things for sure. So.
Okay, well, we're just about at the end of our allotted hour, so yep. I'll start the wrap up. If anybody thinks of anything else, feel free to chip in. So I just want to remind you that the board is looking for some help with presentations. Just topics for meeting presentations that you would be interested in will be useful to us. But certainly if you know of any speakers, if you have relatives or friends or organizations that do interesting things with computers and you think would be willing to give a presentation at the club, we'd be interested in knowing. Individual members are always welcome to put together a presentation. It can be a full 90-minute presentation at a monthly meeting, 15 minutes or so, longer or shorter, at members' favorites. And don't forget members' favorites in September, where the best presentation is going to win that hard drive. And certainly just presentations at Q&A. And you've seen a couple of examples tonight where Chris gave quite a bit of information. And I've just given you some information on encryption. And Bob Walker has a series on e-books, e-readers, that kind of thing. And he has another presentation, the final one in that series, scheduled for next week. So certainly if you have anything that you'd like to share in that kind of area, we'd be more than happy to hear from you. So please send your information to suggestion box. Next up is one of OPL's tech cafes. And Chris Taylor is going to be talking about the wild and weird and wonderful world of social networking. The good, the bad, and the very ugly, as far as I'm concerned. It's on Monday, March the 22nd at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And don't forget, if you want to attend that, you must register with the library because they will send you the log-on credentials for the online session. It's a Zoom session, but it's one controlled by them, not by us. And, of course, finally, next week will be our next question and answer session, March 24th. And, again, questions and topics, chairs, send them along to suggestion box at opcud.ca.
And just before we break, Glenn had a question. Does the SCD slow down the read-write of the disk drive? I don't know what the SCD is.
That's the self-encrypting.
Oh, self-encrypting, yeah, okay. I think on any modern, relatively modern device, the overhead of doing the encryption and decryption is really, really minor. You probably wouldn't really notice it. But it would definitely have some impact, but I think it's like really, really minor amount of impact on the performance.
Yeah.
My belief is with the self-encrypting drives that they sort of come encrypted, but the encryption key is kind of preset to be something. And what you do when you set the self-encryption key is that you change it from what it was to some new value. It's actually, I think, a two-stage affair. But my worry was, when I asked the question, was if you have an existing disk with all kinds of your data on it, then if you set a key for the hard drive, then does it wipe out the stuff that's on the disk already? And my fear has always been that it does, although I have the feeling that it doesn't. So I was hoping to have that clarified, but apparently not.
Well, I think it was actually clarified a little bit by Alan, because he mentioned how in one instance there was the actual encryption key that is used is something totally different. Your access to be able to get to that is that password you put on top of it, and so that doesn't change the encryption key that is actually used for the encryption. It just changes your access to that.
That's so, my understanding.
Yeah. So I think it's a safe operation to do. I don't think it's going to re-encrypt all your files or anything like that. It's that really, really long random key is actually used for the encryption, and it's just, yeah, you have an access to that afterwards.
Well, I guess I'll do an image backup and try it out.
You can let us know if you lost everything.
Sounds like a good follow-up, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, I don't see any other questions, so I think we can wrap it up for the evening. So thanks very much, everybody, for attending, and we will see you next week.
Yeah, good night, everyone.
Me too.
Good night.
Happy St. Paddy's Day.
Yes, and to you. Yeah,
go have a brew.
Yeah.
Or two.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night, Bernie.
Night.